This is Marfa Public Radio's Talk at 10 program. I'm Mark Glover. Today's guest is Richard Walter, an archaeologist with the Center for Big Bend Studies. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Richard, you spent 5 years on the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico. What were you doing there?
Just kind of a thing in my life that I happened to land there. I was going with this Apache girl for a long time, and wound up staying with her family over there.
And was life there much different than the American mainstream?
Yes.
Well, rock art in the Trans-Pecos in Big Bend, what was the inspiration of these drawings, and how old are they, and where did they buy their paint?
Well, historic rock imagery, I'd rather label it, because I don't consider it all of it to be really artwork. But it's typical of showing biographical scenes. Most of it has a lot of elements of European dress and European goods, such as guns, and a lot of religious paraphernalia is incorporated into it, like Spanish crosses, such as that.
So then those biological sketches, I think you call them.
Biographical.
Uh-huh. They're fairly recent. I mean, if they're...
Oh, compared to thousands of years prior to that, yeah.
So they were crosses, crucifixes?
A lot of people on horses, you know, stuff that was brought in from the Europeans. So, you know, obviously it was a big impact on these people.
Uh-huh. And you mentioned some of the things they were from Europe, the technology. Speaking of technology, what do you think were some of the items that the Europeans brought that changed the native way of life?
A lot of metal items, you know, glass items, guns especially, you know.
Guns, yeah.
Yeah.
So the natives at that time were not into metallurgy and glassmaking?
There's some isolated occurrences in Mexico where they practiced metallurgy prior to European contact, but overall the people in this area especially had stone technology. So when these new European goods were brought in, it was quite the thing, you know.
And the horse and the bow and arrow, was that part of that introduction?
Well, no, the horse was part of the introduction, but the bow and arrow was already here.
Uh-huh. So the bow and arrow dates back to 700 AD?
Oh, it started in late prehistoric times, which was probably 500 or 600 years prior to the contact of Europeans.
Now, and before that was the weapon... The weapon of choice for our area was the atlatl, I think it's called.
Atlatl, yeah.
Atlatl. And then the bow and arrow came in.
Then the bow and arrow came gradually, of course.
Uh-huh. And both of those weapons required a sharp point.
Correct. They manufactured projectile points made out of stone.
And... Uh-huh. And as I understand it, you are a flint knapper, among other things.
I'm not a very good one, but, yeah, I can make a crude point, yeah.
And that, so if we walk through this, the men, for the most part, were the hunters of this hunter-gatherer system, and they would go out into the desert with their bow and arrow and hunt rabbits or javelina or whatever came their way.
True. Archaeologically, it's hard to really determine gender roles, but some of the ethnographic records mention that women basically did most of the work as far as food processing and hide preparation and setting camp and all that, while the men were more responsible for hunting and warfare and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And so they would take these projectile points and fit them on... sticks, and I mean, where are we finding most of these arrowheads? Were they in the camps, or were they just scattered about where impact was made with an animal? Or if you're arrow hunter collector, where do you look?
Well, not that I really agree with collecting, since I'm a professional archaeologist, but most of the projectile points are found at their camps, and in some cases there are isolated occurrences of where they cached arrow points.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is believed to have been a ritualistic kind of thing, you know, where they cached them ritualistic instead of planning on coming back and using them later.
I see. So, as I understand it, up in the Davis Mountains, there was a very large catch of arrowheads that wasn't necessarily something that they were storing for future hunting uses. It was more a religious thing, I guess.
That was more ritualistic, yes.
So, if you ran out of arrowheads while you're hunting, you just stop, find a rock, and chip it away and keep going? Is that how it worked?
That's what I do.
Whenever
actually,
you're
rabbit hunting, it doesn't really take a long time to make an arrow point.
And that process is one rock against another. Is that how you do it?
True.
And the best rocks for making arrowheads are what?
Any rock that has a conchoidal fracture, you know, a lot of that stone would be a siliceous stone, cryptocrystalline stone, that like flint or chert or obsidian or agate.
Uh-huh. And we have quite a bit of that out here, I guess.
Yeah, you know, this place is loaded with it.
Uh-huh. So the major tribes in our area in the historic age, which basically started from when Cortez came through here, or was it Cabeza de Vaca?
Well, Cabeza de Vaca, and that's archaeologists have formed a chronological framework where they call the time of contact around 1535 the proto-historic, and it goes on to about 1700. And then from 1700 on is called the historic period.
Mm-hmm. And this historic period then, so the last free-roaming natives in our area was when?
Probably about in the 1880s.
And that was Chief Victorio, I believe.
He was the last, yeah. He was the last one. He was actually massacred in Mexico.
And he was a Lupan Apache or?
No, he was an Eastern Chiricahua.
Eastern Chiricahua.
Or Hot Springs Apache.
Hot Springs Apache. And their range was, they made it up to the Guadalupe Mountains and I think down to the river.
Oh, yeah. One of their frequent excursions was in the Davis Mountains on to El Paso and on down into northern Chihuahua.
Uh-huh. And he was hunted for quite some time, I think.
Yeah, relatively so. But he was pretty much forced to raid, you know. The U.S. government provided conditions intolerable for his family. And therefore, the only option was to raid rancherias and other settlements to make a living, you know.
Mm-hmm. So prior to the raids, what was a day in the life of a native, of someone in Victorio's tribe?
I was mostly hunting and gathering, but during historic times, raiding was a serious component in economy, I know. And they would take their goods from different rancherias, and then they used some of that material to trade for other materials and so on and so on. But hunting and gathering alone didn't make the living, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that lifestyle, in the year of the Battle of the Alamo, everybody knows this, 1836, but further north at a place called Grosbeck, Texas, Comanches attacked and kidnapped a 9-year-old girl named Cynthia Ann Parker, who then spent 24 years with the Comanche and eventually married a chief and gave birth to Quanah Parker, who went on to be a fierce chief himself. How often did these kidnappings occur?
Actually, the taking of captives was part of the economy, the raiding economy, and the Comanche in particular commonly took in some of these captives just to live with them instead of trade to other tribes.
And this young lady grew up, you think, if she spent 24 years there, she probably felt like they were family.
She pretty much became Indian.
Uh-huh. And she's not the first. I mean, this happened quite often.
No, there's several accounts of the same scenario happening.
Mm-hmm. And Sam Houston, the first president or second president of the Republic of Texas, also spent some time with the Comanche, I believe.
I'm not familiar with that.
So these hostages were sometimes taken in as part of the family and sometimes used as commodity.
True. Yeah, the Comanche in particular liked Mexican blacksmiths because they could they could repair some of the metal implements that were traded to them. And some of these, like guns, for example, they used the Spanish and Mexicans usually intentionally traded cheap guns to the Indians because it was a money-making deal. And a lot of times they would break, you know. And a lot of times you'll see at occupation sites where even broken pieces of guns, broken components of guns, have been reworked and made into other tools like hide, you know, perforators, whatever, you know.
Scrapers.
So they utilize even broken pieces of utensils to make other tools.
Mm-hmm. What were some of these cheap guns? Do we know who was responsible? Was it Colt?
No, it was prior to that. I'm not sure.
Now, the Comanche War Trail, or the Comanche Trail, I think it's called, and a roadside sign around Persimmon Gap, that was a trail that went from, I think from the Stockton Plateau into Mexico. What can you tell us about that trail?
Well, the the Comanche Trail was pretty much like used as a corridor to go back and from Mexico on raids. And unlike the Mescalero resided in the mountainous areas of the Trans-Pecos, but the Comanche and other plains tribes like the Kiowa, Apache, the Southern Cheyenne, so on, they basically just used the Comanche Trail as a corridor to go back to Mexico.
On raids, or not
right.
Necessarily
raids. It was a raiding trail.
Which brings us to Cormac McCarthy and his book Blood Meridian. There were bounties being paid by the Chihuahuan government to certain groups to take the scalps of certain natives. When did that start?
It was after Mexico became Mexico. And anyway, it was a policy. The Apache raiding became so intense that they thought that would be a way to solve it by just offering a bounty on scalps, but that got out of hand because at one point, I believe Durango offered as much as $200 a head. So people would come in here and try to get rich, and they would even kill anybody that had black hair, you know, and claim it to be Indian.
And they would take these dried out scalps and bring them to the capital in Chihuahua and say, pay up.
That's right.
Some of these men or scalp hunters were on their way to the California gold fields, I guess, at the time.
That's true, and some of them just decided to become scalp hunters because they thought it was more profitable than striking it rich in the gold fields.
Yeah, well, $200, that was quite a bit of money back then.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Richard Walter, archaeologist for the Center for Big Bend Studies, on today's program. Cabeza de Vaca coined the term humano, but it seemed this was a very general term. Was there a humano tribe?
Yeah, there was a humano tribe, but it's that the term humano has been subject to debate because the early Spanish explorers, every expedition they would name tribes, and unfortunately, every expedition had their own version. So you have a suite of versions of Humano, but there was we know that the Humano were generally known as a nomadic people that were hunter-gatherers. They go out to the plains around the Pecos River and hunt bison, and occasionally they would visit the villages in La Junta to trade.
The La Junta being the confluence of the...
Right, the area where the Rio Conchos meets the Rio Grande.
Okay. So the buffalo or American bison provided, as I understand, the Plains Indians with food, shelter, art, and certain spiritual identity. Can you tell us about the relationship the Indians had with buffalo?
Not so much for this area because there were certain nomadic groups that hunted bison, but not so much as the ones to groups living in the plains. But bison was a major element in subsistence strategies, but I'm not sure about what kind of element the bison had how much of an impact bison had in people's lives. People that lived around here.
Well, prior to the Spanish invasion or exploration of our area, what was the spiritual aspect of some of the tribes that lived in our area? Do we know much about that?
No, we really don't. We really don't know.
We have their artwork, but it's not always depicting their god or goddesses or...
Who knows? A lot of the prehistoric rock imagery is abstract in nature, and you could just go on and on trying to interpret what it really means. But since there's no written record or no written accounts, it's really hard to, confidently say what it means.
So the last free-roaming Indians in the Trans-Pecos... Mescalero Apache.
Partial. It was by that time at the very end there was Chiricahua and Mescalero and Lapan. Everybody was just mixed.
And these bands or tribes were sighted as late as I think you told me earlier, 1890 near Shafter.
That's true. And even as late as 1920 in northern Mexico.
So at this point, I guess the culmination of manifest destiny or the European expedition across our continent basically conquered the natives and sent them to Oklahoma.
Not so much here. I don't know about here. Most of them were sent to Mescalero or San Carlos in Arizona.
These are reservations in New Mexico.
True.
And Arizona.
True.
And the reservations in Oklahoma were, I guess, the trail of...
A lot of Plains tribes. That's home for many Plains tribes and also Eastern tribes, like the Cherokee and the Choctaw.
Trail of Tears, I believe it was called.
Right.
And Texas itself has no reservations at all.
There's three here. There's Alabama, Coushatta, the Tewa, and there's Kickapoo.
One of them is Isleta in El Paso.
That's, yeah.
Which that's, one? That's Tigua?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And that's just a small area in El Paso within the city limits, or am
I? Right. It's not what most people think of as a reservation. It's more of a urban area set aside for them.
Uh-huh. We're speaking with Richard Walter, archaeologist for the Center for Big Bend Studies. Richard, tell me, some tribes were friendly to the white settler, and often there was reciprocation. But the famous saying, white man speak with forked tongue, any truth to that?
That's an understatement, of course.
I guess we're all guilty of some infraction along the line in life. Now, when I bought my house in Alpine, I had to sign a document stating that there was a lawsuit which would eventually come to trial, stating that the Tigua tribe claimed that land and claimed a lot of land around here. What do we know about that?
You know, I have no idea what this means. I don't know the history of how that came about, but I've heard of several other people in this area that had to sign some kind of a paper saying they acknowledged that the Tiwa claimed that wherever their property is was once Tiwa lands.
Getting back to everyday life of the historic native in the Trans-Pecos, what was it like to be a woman in one of these tribes?
Frankly, I don't know. I guess, like we were talking earlier, your role would be doing a lot of the labor-intensive tasks, daily domestic tasks during the day.
And the language of these tribes, could a Lupan Mescalero Indian, sorry, that's wrong.
Lupan.
Speak directly with the Comanche? Could they understand each other?
They would have probably had to use sign language because they're both distinct linguistic roots. They have different linguistic roots. The Apache is Athabascan linguistic roots, while the Comanche is Uto-Aztecan.
Okay, so they're far removed, I guess, as
True.
Far as language. Mm-hmm. Well, good. That's been our program today. Richard Walter with the Center for Big Bend Studies. Richard, thank you for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
That's today's program, Talk at 10, Marfa Public Radio. I'm Mark Lover.